This is your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to discuss Trump's war on wind and renewable energy. Last Wednesday, Russ Vogt, Trump's budget director, tweeted, "Nearly $8 billion in green new scam funding to fuel the left's climate agenda is being canceled. More info to come from the Department of Energy." He went on to write that the projects are in 16 states that voted for Harris, including California, Oregon, and Vermont. Critics say the move is not legal. The Trump administration has been waging an intense war on wind projects. According to The Guardian's Darna Noor and Oliver Millman, the scale of the intervention is remarkable. A total of 9 permitted offshore wind projects that were set to provide electricity to nearly 5 million households and create about 9,000 jobs in the U.S. are under investigation or have already been paused by the Trump administration. So where does that leave the industry now? What is the outlook, and what is in store for the future of wind energy? Darna Noor is a fossil fuels and climate reporter at The Guardian US. Hi, Darna. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you back. Aidan Hughes is a reporter with Inside Climate News. His recent piece is called "With Federal Support for Wind and Solar Waning, States Are Trying to Push Policy Through on Their Own." Hi, Aidan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, Darna, let's start off with you. I mean, last time around, Trump did so much damage to the environment. And he, again, is pushing for more oil and gas. He's threatening countries to abandon their efforts to wane off fossil fuels. But he has such an intense hatred for wind energy. He calls turbines ugly, disgusting, garbage. He's labeled support for wind and solar the scam of the century. Where does this deep-rooted hostility toward wind come from?
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, obviously, I cannot look into, maybe thankfully, I cannot look into the soul of Donald Trump and see exactly where, you know, this deep-rooted hate originates. But I will say that he seemed to sort of first signal his distaste for wind energy around 14 years ago. He was in Scotland, and he was fiercely opposing these plans for an offshore wind farm that was set to be built near a golf resort that he had opened there. He said that the turbines were going to ruin his view. He said they would destroy tourism. Perhaps it goes without saying, but there was very little evidence that it would actually destroy tourism. But Trump then basically launched like these public campaigns against the projects. He sued the developers. He called wind farms monstrous. He called them environmental disasters. The Scottish government actually did end up approving the development despite Trump's efforts. He lost all of his court challenges. But I think this sort of became emblematic of his, I don't know, I think kind of wild and crazy making hostility towards wind energy. And now clearly we're seeing that play out within the U.S. and in some cases even globally.
And it's really incredible to see this happening because as you report, I mean, you've got a graph here about these threatened offshore wind projects that were set to power about 5 million homes.
Yeah.
The South Coast wind, Maryland offshore wind, coastal Virginia offshore wind, New England wind 2, Vineyard wind 1. It just goes down the line. Officials halted a Revolution wind project off the coast of Rhode Island, which is 80% complete, although work was allowed to resume by a federal judge on Monday. And you wrote this piece on September 24th. So
right.
Can you just talk about just how massive this has been, that he is going after these huge, these are huge wind projects?
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. You know, we're talking just a few days after, or actually just one day, I guess, after the Financial Times published this really interesting interview with the top executive of Shell, the big oil company in the U.S., where she basically called the Trump administration's decision to halt permitting on a bunch of offshore wind farms really damaging, and basically warned that like a future Democratic president could use that precedent to attack the oil and gas industry. And last week in New York, I actually had the opportunity to ask Trump's energy secretary, Chris Wright, if he would support Democratic presidents in the future pulling permits for fossil fuel projects that had already been permitted. And he sort of responded, well, you know, they've already done it. So what's to stop us from doing this? the scale of attack that we've seen on offshore wind and wind in general, really, from the Trump administration is pretty stunning. I think it sort of started, you know, obviously when Trump was on the campaign trail, but the first maybe direct action that we saw was in January when, you know, they issued this executive order pausing all new offshore wind leases. They, after that, rescinded a bunch of previously, or all really previously designated wind areas in federal waters. And then they also withdrew hundreds of millions of dollars in grants and loans for offshore wind infrastructure. More to the point here, they have also attacked nine already permitted wind projects, some of which are under construction, as you mentioned, up to 80% constructed already. Wind projects, and these are, again, ones that have already been permitted, ones that have already gone through this long, arduous process of being greenlit, you know, around the East Coast and beyond. And, you know, this is obviously coming at a time when the U.S. is seeing a massive spike in energy demand. And so, you know, I think a lot of people are really concerned about the effect here, not only on labor, but also on the ability to actually ensure that we have a stable grid moving forward.
Well, and Darna, we shouldn't have to say this. It's obvious, but it's not like all of these wind companies are run by Democrats.
Yes.
So, I mean, he's hitting people across the board on this because, I mean, we're talking about a lot of money. According to Reuters, in August, the administration said it was canceling $679 million in federal funding for 12 offshore wind projects.
Yes, it's absolutely true. This is certainly going to hit both red states and blue states. And really heartbreakingly, I spoke with a number of folks representing the building trades in the New England area, where several of these wind farms were slated to be built. And many of them said, you know, a majority of our members actually supported Trump on the grounds that he promised to be really good for working people in New England and beyond. And many of them, I think, are having a really just awful wake-up call that they never should have had to have. Many of them are sort of, I think, saying, hey, we put this guy into office because he said that he would support blue-collar workers like us, so what gives?
Right. And Aiden, as you have reported, this is not just affecting Democratic states. This is also affecting Republican states.
It's absolutely affecting Republican states. And this battle over renewable energy and wind energy especially has spread from the federal government to the state government. According to a report from the think tank Clean Tomorrow, over 300 state-level siting bills have been introduced in the first half of 2025. Half of those would have made siting and permitting more restrictive for renewable energy, which is significantly more than the bills that would have had a neutral impact and those that would have been permissive. So that's about 150 bills that would have been restrictive versus only 68 that would have made it easier to develop renewable energy projects. And that pushback against renewables, like the recent actions at the federal level, is largely driven by the GOP. So we're seeing this impact not just Democratic states, but also Republican states. And in many cases, such as Texas and Iowa, those Republican states are some of the places where they benefit the most from renewable energy, whether it's solar or wind projects.
Right. So how are Republicans in these states responding, the Republicans that actually support renewable energy?
Well, it's been a mix. And with the folks that I spoke with at Clean Tomorrow said that they were seeing a little bit less uniformity at the state level in Republicans' views on renewable energy than what we're seeing at the federal level. So you do have some Republicans that are introducing a slew of bills that are going to make it more difficult or would make it more difficult to build renewable energy projects in the state. But you also have some that are pushing back against that. And Oklahoma is a prime example of that dynamic. The state's attorney general has publicly denounced wind energy as a green energy scam, and the Republican-controlled legislature passed three bills that would have had a restrictive impact on the deployment of renewable energies. But Governor Kevin Stitt, who's also a Republican, vetoed two of those bills. The legislature overrode one of those vetoes, and the governor has been unabashedly pro-renewables. So it's a little bit more of an interesting story at the state level because you do still have parts of the GOP that are following the president's lead and are pushing back against wind energy development and solar energy development. But you also have people who are kind of more along the lines of the more traditional Republican approach, which was an all of the above energy approach, which meant welcoming some of these renewable energy projects.
You interviewed Nelson Falkenberg policy manager at Clean Tomorrow and one of the report's authors, who said there's a huge subset of these bills that legislators are introducing because they have constituents who are upset about renewable energy or they're trying to score political points. There are some that are purely messaging, and there are others that have real traction and are advancing quickly through their state legislatures.
That's correct. And Arizona's SB 1150 is a good example of that. You have some bills that are being introduced that are just symbolic. They're meant to score political points. But you have others like this bill in Arizona that made real progress in the legislature before it stalled out in the state Senate. And if that bill had passed, it would have been the most restrictive wind development law in the United States. Now, thankfully for the renewable energy industry, the vast majority of these efforts to restrict renewable energy at the state level haven't been successful. Of the roughly 300 siting bills introduced in the first half of the year, just under 40 were signed into law. And that was about an even number of wins and losses for the renewable energy industry. So despite this onslaught of bills being introduced at the state level to restrict renewable energy development, we're seeing that they're not having as much success at the state level as they are at the federal level, rolling back some of these projects.
And Darna, you write that right-leaning Americans still overwhelmingly back the all-of-the-above approach. Polling released by Kress shows a total of 85% of Republican voters support all of the above, with nearly three-quarters wanting the United States to use clean energy to help cut planet heating pollution.
Absolutely. I think this sort of speaks to a broader trend that we're seeing amongst Americans where, you know, despite headlines that I think rightfully point out that many Americans are kind of letting climate slip a bit in their political priorities in favor of economic issues that seem, I think, reasonably a bit more urgent, we're not really seeing support for these kinds of attacks on renewable energy from the Trump administration, even from Americans who really want to preserve the fossil fuel economy that we've seen. There's a lot of interest in diversification. We've seen these recent campaigns in support of solar energy from, environmental activists like Bill McKibben, who have really been highlighting the ability for solar panels placed on homes or placed on balconies to kind of allow your home to feel like your castle, to shield you from the grid and allow you to be completely independent in the face of blackouts. And I think that that's the kind of message we're going to be seeing from, you know, folks on the left trying to bring folks on the right into the fight to support renewable energy in the future. And again, you know, this is not at all good for jobs. And I think folks on both sides of the American political spectrum would really like to ensure that, especially as inflation rises, especially as, utility bills rise, would like to ensure that we see good blue collar jobs pervade around America. We've seen that a very easy way to bring those online is to ensure that we're bringing on more renewable energy because it is very quick to bring online, unlike things like fossil fuels.
On today's One Planet series, we are talking about Trump's war on wind and renewable energy. Darna Noor is a fossil fuels and climate reporter with The Guardian US. Aidan Hughes is a reporter with Inside Climate News. There was an interesting story in the New York Times in early September by Maxine Joselow and Brad Plumer. And they've got a piece called "The Lone GOP Governor Opposing Trump's War on Offshore Wind." They write, "There's one East Coast wind farm that has so far escaped the administration's ire, an almost $11 billion project under construction off the shores of Virginia, where Governor Glenn Youngkin, a Republican, has been its champion. Youngkin has quietly pushed back against Trump's war on wind energy. A supporter of Trump, the governor has privately urged the administration not to target the project known as Coastal Virginia Offshore Wind, according to four people briefed on the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe private conversations." Darna, what can you tell us about this? I mean, are they just going after blue states? And I mean, do you have any update on the wind project in Virginia?
I mean, it's interesting. Maxine and Brad are correct that, that Trump has not, that there's no evidence, I guess, that Trump is specifically going after the permits for the Coastal Virginia Offshore Wind Project. We do know, however, that Lee Zeldin of the Trump administration has said that the Trump administration has ongoing investigations into all offshore wind projects. I think it'll be something that'll be interesting to look for in the future. You know, I do want to note too that like there has been some local funding for port and logistics infrastructure connected to that coastal Virginia offshore wind projects that have been cut. That's at the sort of Norfolk Portsmouth Marina terminal. So I think that, you know, it could be actually more difficult even if we don't see direct attacks on this wind farm for it to come online. But yeah, I think it's interesting to note, and we'll be definitely looking to in the future, you know, the Trump administration's particular moves there.
Well, and again, this is a massive project. I think almost $11 billion. According to the Times, it's about 60% complete. Once finished, the farm would be the nation's largest, consisting of 176 turbines that could generate 2.6 gigawatts of electricity, or enough to power up to 660,000 homes. And right now, it's on track to be up and running next year. And Aiden, as you write, renewable energy is popular among politicians, some in red states, but mostly, apparently, like Youngkin, quietly behind closed doors. As you write, these are cheap sources of energy. They can be constructed fast. They produce electricity, a fair amount of electricity. They impact local economies. They provide thousands of jobs. And so there are so many benefits all around, given the state of emergency that we're currently in.
There are. And Glenn Youngkin certainly isn't the only Republican who is quietly pushing back against the Trump administration's actions on wind energy. You have Senator John Curtis of Utah and Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa place holds on Treasury nominees that the Trump administration is looking to get through the Senate as a result of uncertainty around how the Trump administration was going to issue guidance on some of the tax credits for wind energy projects and solar energy projects. So you have Republicans who are behind the scenes pushing back against some of the Trump administration's actions and are advocating for wind energy, advocating for solar energy. But a lot of people are, you know, seemingly a little bit hesitant to come out and do that in public and risk instigating the president, because he has been so publicly anti-wind energy, not just now, but in his first term and before he ever came to office.
Right. Darna, how are these companies responding? You write that in June, Atlantic Shores, the company behind a planned wind farm off New Jersey's coast, asked the state to cancel its contract after Trump's EPA yanked its permit for the project. The firms behind Empire Wind 2 off New Jersey also canceled their contract, citing economic concerns and supply chain issues.
Yeah, I think what we've seen across the board is that, you know, companies are describing a pretty major write down because of this pretty bleak outlook on future projects. You know, it's worth noting, I think, that when we're talking about these wind developments that have long been in some cases permitted, we're also talking about a massive amount of foreign spending that's gone into them. You know, Ørsted, for instance, had poured, you know, in essence, millions of dollars into ensuring that its projects were going to be able to come online. Again, we also have seen, I keep coming back to this point, but we've also seen sort of thousands of American families become dependent on the work that these were going to provide. And so when we see, I think, something like a Revolution Wind being attacked, when we see something like a coastal wind being a project being attacked, I think what we're seeing is, you know, foreign investment. We're seeing families. We're seeing so much at threat here. And again, worth noting, there are big oil companies that also are quite concerned about the Trump administration's attacks on offshore wind specifically.
Right. I mean, there's so much money at stake here. The LA Times had a piece in mid-September by Haley Smith. California is not backing down on offshore wind power despite Trump cancellation. Haley Smith writes, the Trump administration canceled nearly $500 million in federal funding for California's largest offshore wind project. The state is staying the course with voter-approved funding from the California Climate Bond and other efforts to support wind development. California has an ambitious goal of 25 gigawatts of floating offshore wind energy by 2045. Again, if you can jump in here, Aiden, and just talk about, how massive these projects are. Because things are moving so fast and we just can't keep up with the news, a lot of people might not know that there were so many or are so many wind projects in the works. And again, we're talking about a lot of money and massive, massive projects.
Yeah, we're talking about a lot of money. We're talking about massive projects, and we're talking about huge economic costs as well. If we can talk about the One Big Beautiful Bill Act as an example. So what the One Big Beautiful Bill Act did was it gave what some critics have described as giveaways to the fossil fuel industry, making lands available for mining, making lands available for drilling. But at the same time, it significantly sped up the phase out of tax credits for renewable energy projects, and specifically wind and solar. And that impact is going to have a real effect on American households. You know, I spoke with Dan O'Brien, a senior modeling analyst at the climate policy think tank Energy Innovation. And he said that, you know, 20 additional gigawatts in generation capacity from fossil fuels can be expected by 2035 as a result of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. That's compared to a decrease of 360 gigawatts. The difference between those numbers, a decrease of 344 gigawatts, is roughly equivalent to the energy use of about 100 million homes. So these projects that are being built have a real impact on the energy that's available to American consumers, the energy that's available to people who are trying to speed up the AI race in our competition with China, and the scale back of these technologies and of investment in these technologies is going to have a real impact on our ability to compete and achieve what the Trump administration has described as its ultimate goal of energy dominance.
And Darna, final thoughts from you. We don't have time to wait around for this or to figure out what this administration is going to do, because scientists say that we've got to cut global carbon emissions in half by about 2030 and zero them around 2040. And that's right around the corner.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think this is especially important to note in light of something that Aidan just mentioned, which is that we're seeing, you know, not only the massive need to transition away from fossil fuels, but also the massive increase in energy demand. You know, we saw that PJM, which is the grid for New England, the grid for much of the sort of eastern United States, we saw that grid operators there said the primary reason that they were having to increase the price of electricity is because of the massive onslaught of essentially energy demand from AI data centers. So we're at this period where, you know, not only do we have a grid that needs to be electrified and needs to be taken away from fossil fuels, we also have a massive increase in demand coming from that sort of race to bring more AI data centers online. What this means is that, you know, we could be looking at a future where there's more energy, more fossil fuels are used to power it because more energy demand, more fossil fuels are used to power it because, you know, the Trump administration has eliminated the possibility for renewables to come online. And in the meantime, we're going to see energy bills skyrocket. We're going to see utility bills skyrocket because, you know, of the sort of basic laws of supply and demand. I think that this is it could be a real crisis, not only for, you know, the sort of climate, but also for, you know, the household costs of Americans in the meantime. So all around a lose-lose, I would say.
Yeah, this is such a good point. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, after more than a decade of little change, U.S. electricity consumption is rising again. And thank you, Darna. We always have to talk about these AI centers, and we'll do another show about that. And then Wired has a piece, why U.S. power bills are surging, residential electricity rates have risen fast across the U.S., more than 30% on average since 2020. So this is all so connected. So thank you for bringing that up, Darna. Darna Noor is a fossil fuels and climate reporter at Guardian U.S. Aidan Hughes is a reporter with Inside Climate News. Darna and Aidan, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much. And you can find links to the articles we talked about today at KALW.org, click news, and then your call. Coming up tomorrow, we'll rebroadcast our show about why Obama and Biden voters didn't vote at all or voted for Trump. And then on our authoritarian playbook on Wednesday, we'll speak with Raoul Peck, the acclaimed Haitian filmmaker and director who's out with a new documentary, Orwell, 2+2=5. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.